Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. As always, smash that subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you all because boarding the mothership is Roy Schwartz. He is the writer of the fascinating new book, Is Superman Circumcised? Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Schwartz. Thank you so much for coming to Traversing the Stars podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's totally my pleasure. I've really enjoyed reading your current work, Is Superman Circumcised? And I look forward to talking about it in just a little bit.
Sounds good.
So the first question I usually ask is a question of inspiration, but with you, I want to talk about comic books. When did you first fall in love with comics, and which comic books were the first ones to grab your imagination?
So I grew up in Tel Aviv in Israel, and I don't remember the first moment, the big bang moment of falling in love with comics, because they've always been there. But I do remember, so in 1986, as anybody listening to this podcast I'm sure knows, DC Comics rebooted and they restarted all their comic books. What not many people know is that they used the opportunity to try and push into foreign markets. And they actually had a lot of comics translated into all kinds of languages, all kinds of countries. So you had John Byrne's Man of Steel miniseries and the new Superman. They had a bunch of issues of Jim Aparo Batman that were translated. There was the George Perez Wonder Woman, all these kind of things. So I started reading these things in Hebrew and then gradually making way to English. And I actually taught myself English by reading comics. Which is why today you'll catch me saying things like swell and great Scott.
That's awesome. As someone who I'm Jewish as well, but I've never lived in visited Israel, though I probably is one of those long-term bucket list goals of mine. How has living in Israel given you a different perspective on American comic books?
Oh, it's a good question. Several ways. First of all, I'm an immigrant. I'm an American citizen. I came here, I struck roots and all that kind of stuff. Very proud American citizen, but I'm always going to have that immigrant skewed perspective, which is something that Clark Kent has. Granted, he was raised here and for all intents and purposes, all he knows is being an American, but he still has a very strong cultural heritage and a very strong momentum of that. And that's definitely that kind of perspective, that insider-outsider perspective I bring with me. The other thing is, I grew up reading comics in the language of the Ten Commandments. There are certain cultural weights that you bring with you, for better or worse, as somebody who's Jewish, somebody who speaks Hebrew. I'm always going to see things from that kind of slightly more objective look at American culture and everything it means and those kind of things. In addition to that, just the lived experiences. I served 3 years in the IDF, it's conscripted service. I was in counterterrorism intelligence during wartime. And that absolutely informs not just my approach as a historian and critic of pop culture, but also as a writer myself. I'm able to imbue my writing with greater verisimilitude or analyze things from a slightly more mature perspective.
Now, everyone knows Superman, and I think you discuss in your book as well, the idea that when they discuss Superman, that what he stands for, it's always truth, justice, and the American way. Now, as someone reading it in Israel, how did that strike you? Did it strike you as odd or even arrogant how the idea of American way is used? But I'm sure in Israel, you guys view truth and justice and all that as just as important things. And I wonder how that impacted you as a reader of Superman.
So a few things. First of all, Israeli culture shares its values with American culture. Israel is different from America, the same way that Canada is different from America or Australia is different from, they're not that different. And the values are different. There's a reason why there's the coinage Judeo-Christian values. And I would say that America and Israel are very much the bigger brother and smaller brother, but they're siblings very much so. that in Israel you look up to Americans anyway, you know, you look at it. And first of all, you know, it hasn't always been truth just in the American way. It actually started out for Superman as truth and justice. They added the American way during World War II. They took it out after World War II. Then they brought it back in the 50s. And then it sort of stuck around. But actually in the comics, aside from covers, he only mentions that a couple of times in sort of a straightforward way, not as in some army general criticizing him or something. You know, in the entire 83 years of Superman, he only actually says it in the comics sincerely two or three times ever. So it's not, you know, that said, I don't think I can speak for myself, not for 8 million Israelis, but I never understood the American way to being representative of contemporary American culture or American foreign policy or American civic. It's American values. Mm. It's pluralism. It's peace through pluralism. It's life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. These are values that were phrased in the most beautiful way in the American Constitution, but they are universal human rights or inalienable human rights. That's at least what I believe in.
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny because it reminds me of Superman Returns that started a huge uproar when I think it was Perry White. He said he used the truth, trust, American way thing, but he changed it to like truth, American. And like, and I can't remember, it was either like he said something like all that stuff, or he kind of minimized the American way part. And that became a huge uproar in this country of, oh my God, they're, you know, insulting Superman and the American way and all the other stuff.
Right.
So
he does say,
right. So according to you, that wasn't even a major part of the mythos of Superman that people got so upset about.
That is more a part of the mythos of Superman in the public conception, not in the actual canon of any kind. I don't have a problem with it at all, but you know, is it dated? Is it a bit anachronistic? Is it maybe nationalistic? Yes. I personally don't have a problem with it, but that's not, you know, and when he says, does he still stand for truth, justice, all that stuff? It did cause quite an uproar, and it was followed 3 years later in Action Comics 900. They had a short story written by David Goyer, the guy who went on to write Man of Steel and Cry Batman v Superman, where Superman renounces his American citizenship, saying truth, justice, the American way, it's not enough anymore. I need to be a global citizen. Mm. And that sort of got expunged from canon almost immediately when they did the New 52 reboot. And actually thought that was in bad taste and sort of misunderstood the character. Although I put in the book that Superman renounces citizenship, not Clark Kent. And that opens the door to all kinds of interpretations. But, you know, and now in the comics it's truth, justice, and a better tomorrow. Before then, they experimented briefly with truth, justice, and a better world, which I actually liked better. I think it rolls off the tongue better. So yeah, you know, some people have an issue with that and some people have an issue with that. Everybody has an ownership of Superman, whether they've ever read Action Comics or know what it is or not. I like the American way, but I'm also comfortable with a better world.
You know, I kind of like what you're saying about the idea that Superman renounced, but not Clark Kent. Because good point, because Superman does not have a Social Security card. Clark Kent does, but not Superman. He's not actually himself. And that guy's a citizen. Neither is, I guess, Kal-El at that point, in that version.
Right. And it begs the question of who's the real guy and all that kind of stuff, right? That is its own can of worms for Superman.
Which I think is one of those great stories. And obviously they have that argument with Batman as well all the time. Which one, is it the mask, or is Batman the mask, or is Bruce Wayne the mask? I think the first time they ever said with Superman is that, at least in my opinion, Clark Kent was always... he's always Clark Kent, and Superman is the costume he has to wear to do what he has to do. But to me, it's always been that Clark Kent has been the true essence of the character. I don't know how you felt about that.
They, you know, they have this great line in Lois and Clark in Tempest Fugit, which is episode 19, when he says, Clark is who I am, Superman is what I can do.
That's a great line. Yeah, that really is a great line.
Yeah, and they rehashed that in Supergirl in one of the seasons. You know, psychologically, he's Clark Kent, you know. Even in some origins where they depict him as like a three-year-old leaving Krypton, there's a couple of issues like that. He still really grew up as an American. He really thinks of himself as an American. And if you look at the real original Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster OOV from the early years, Krypton is just an excuse to give him powers. He's just like an American. that said, it's not disguised as Superman. It's disguised as Clark Kent, right? the true inner self, the fantasy is Superman. And who he grew up in may be named Clark, but personality-wise, that was Superman. That was not mild-mannered Clark Kent. And in a way, when he left the farm Clark became Superman, and then a whole new Clark came to be, which is Metropolis, called the bumbling. Hmm. So without even bringing Clark Kent into the thing. So it's more complicated. It's not such a binary. But that, I think, is what makes the character so rich and interesting. And I say in the book, you know, at heart, he is Clark Kent, a red-blooded American guy. But that heart is not human. You know, he was born and will always be a Superman. Whereas, you know, Bruce Wayne died with his parents, you know, in Crime Alley. That night, Batman was born. Psychologically, he's Batman. He puts on the mask, his real self comes out. Great. But it's totemic. He's not half bat. You know, it's Superman is a Superman. He is, you know, Kryptonian. So psychologically, his personality, the way he thinks of himself, maybe Clark Kent. But he was really born Kal-El, and that's who he is first and foremost.
So because he, as you're saying, because he is from Krypton and he is superpowered, and Superman is not only what he can do, but as you said, what he is the humble aspect of him, for lack of a better word, partly almost a fraud, that he is forcing himself to act that way because of what he knows he could do if he wasn't that way?
Well, that's the Kill Bill, right, soliloquy, which, interestingly enough, is almost verbatim taken from the great comic book Heroes, the book, which I think is such a verbatim quote, almost verbatim, that it's supposed to be a clear homage, but nobody seems to have picked up on it. So it's not original to Kill Bill, that kind of speech. But, you know, I don't think it's fake. I don't think he's making fun of us. I don't think, maybe it's penance in a way. You know, he wants to walk in our shoes because he flies above us. Mm. But he's a god aspiring to manhood. He wants to belong. He wants to be accepted. He wants to be an American. He wants to be with Lois. An interesting thing is Lois showed up in Action Comics number one, the same time that Clark Kent showed up, the same time that Superman showed up. And from the very first issue, he wooed her. He hit on her as Clark, not as Superman. Mm. You know, you could say that's fake, but that's who he wants to be loved as. That's who he wants to connect to people as. So there's this really interesting schizoid quality to his personality. That's without going into the, you know, the metaphor behind things. That's just looking at him as a real personality.
Well, I mean, I guess it would be almost like, it's a horrible analogy, I'm going to use it anyway, screw it. The idea of a wealthy person or a celebrity who does not want to be loved for their money, because that's something that causes disingenuousness in the person they're who's being pursued, or they're is pursuing them. So Clark Kent, obviously, Superman would not want to be pursued for Superman, because obviously there's a huge benefit to just being around that. So you would want to be, I guess, adored or loved for the non-special aspect, or at least the part that if you're loved as Clark Kent, the odds are that's more genuine than if someone loves you as Superman, because obviously you're loved for what you can then do for them, in my opinion, or unless I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. And it brings to mind Superman 2, the Christopher Reeve one, where he gives up his powers for Lois, and she almost immediately falls out of love with him.
That's a good
and
he point.
Goes like, I wish that guy was here. And then at the very end, she goes, don't tell me I'll find somebody, a tough act to follow. Well, were you in love with the act, or were you in love with this personality?
Right, like, right. I mean, one thing I do love about Superman, and it's interesting how different writers throughout history for Superman have all given their own interpretations of the character, but in a real way have still maintained a very solid thread throughout, and I think that's something interesting, that no matter who the writer is, and he has some wonderful writers have worked on Superman even recently, you know, like Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, all that stuff, but they've been able to still mentally keep the thread alive, which is interesting. That means Superman is the stronger than the talent that's been working on him in that many ways.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he is mythology, and it's interesting, you know, on the same token, if you think about it, I don't think we've ever had a bad Superman actor. We've had ones that we liked more, ones that we liked less, but there's never been a bad Superman actor who had no business playing him, you know, and so we're very lucky in that way. That's more than I can say for Batman, you know? So we're very lucky in that way, and the thing about Superman, people like saying that he's not relatable. I don't think it's true. I think people just decided it's true. Those are not the same thing. You know, I think that's its own mythology. And the thing is, first of all, there are plenty of characters that, what, Thor is relatable. There are plenty of characters that, so don't tell me it's a power, because he's not that powerful. He doesn't walk into a room and the giant robot falls apart. You know, compared to other characters that we have out there, he's not the Silver Surfer. He's not, you know, arguably Doctor Strange is more powerful. He's not that powerful. If you talk about relatability, Clark Kent is more relatable than Bruce Wayne. You know, since when is like a billionaire that goes out and punches people in alleys, you know, who's like this, like, he's a good guy, but he's a psychopath, who's super intense, who has no personality going on beyond this intensity. Who's like, he's relatable just because he's supposedly human. You know, Clark Kent is us. He's the guy who wakes up in the morning and just wants to figure out how to do the right thing and how to not screw. You know, I mean, that sort of thread of thought really reaches its apex in Peter Parker, who's like the ultimate everyman.
Yes.
But it starts with Clark Kent, and I think he's more relatable than most of the superheroes. So my view of it is very different.
You know, it kind of just reminds me of a meme that I've been seeing going around Facebook. It's actually kind of funny about Batman, that if Batman was real, he'd still be the most normal billionaire in the country.
It's very cool to hate billionaires, but some of them are doing the right thing. And Warren Buffett is a good example of somebody who's, you know, aside the fact that he's already donated by commitment his entire fortune, he is doing an awful lot of charity work and an awful lot of good political work. So, you know, whether I agree with him or not is not the issue. It's the fact that he cares and he does.
Right.
So, you know, they're not all Lex Luthor clones, you know.
Right. I think one thing that's kind of interesting is, and I think goes to what's being done with Superman maybe in the movie, Snyderverse, let's, for instance. There's been Superman over the last 10, maybe 20 years has been a question of how relatable and whether or not he's too quaint for modern audiences. So something like Man of Steel was the attempt to make him more relatable by giving him almost like, Marvel style troubles and doubts and all that other stuff. When they're trying to make him more relatable, are they missing the point of Superman, which is he's not necessarily relatable, but he is the ideal?
It's a good question. And I think not. I think the answer is no. I think sometimes people and creatives as well misunderstand what relatable means. Relatable doesn't mean that he needs to be less powerful. But although, yes, I don't like it when he can sneeze away a solar system. That's just, you know, it's not interesting. Relatable is his personality. The thing is, so he has troubles and he has to make some moral compromises. And that's sort of a Marvel method. But where's the personality? Where's the struggle of him not just kind of staring and gazing and speechifying and strutting, but where's the actual humanity there? Where's the guy who says, I really want to do the right thing and I have no idea what to do? And not Jonathan Kent telling him, well, maybe you should have let a school bus full of children drown to keep your secret. That's insane. You know, and compared to the 1978 of, you know, you are here for a reason and it's not to score touchdowns, you can compare that kind of stuff. And he's not perfect. He's never been perfect. If you read the original comics, actually one of his things is that he's a hothead and he sometimes gets carried away and he has to kind of cool his jets. And I thought that was a really good, you know, because he's a man of action. He's always on the go. And stopping himself is the hard part. But I think that's where his relatability should be. It's that kind of, well, you know, am I doing the right thing? And can I control myself? And the fact that everything I do or say means something, you know, just like a president would, you know. But you need to give him personality, not identity. We're a little bit too caught up with the what instead of the who. And you can take that to all kinds of levels of culture. But I think the issue with the relatability is not his power or his challenges, but just his personality. How much personality did the Cavill version have, really?
Yeah, you know, it kind of reminds me, there was an episode, I'm trying to remember which one it is. Maybe Justice League Animated Series. I don't know, did you ever watch the Justice League Animated Series?
For my book, I have watched every episode of every show, every movie, listened Holy to every crap. Video episode. And get this, read every comic book, mainstream comic book of Superman, not about, like, you know, guest appearances, ever published, ever since 1938, as well as every article in mainstream American press since then. So
well,
there's a lot of work, yeah.
You know, it would be pointless to get into an argument with you about Superman, is all I'm going to say.
No. Just that you read and watched doesn't mean I know better than anybody else.
But the episode I'm thinking about is there's an episode where he's fighting Darkseid, and he's walking out of the building. He's like, I live in a world made out of paper. And he's saying, this is my rare chance for me to, I can't remember, the, like, not unwind, but let loose.
Let loose. That's the very last episode of the show.
Yeah, and it was a fantastic. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Wow.
And I think it was interesting because I'd never seen Superman handled in that way where you let him stop, you know, you kind of like let drop the veneer of, you know, the good boy, the Boy Scout. And now he's like, I'm really been wanting to kick someone's ass for a long time. Now I finally get to just let it all out. And I think it was an interesting take on his character.
Yeah, I think, you know, that show had its strengths and weaknesses. There were things about it I liked a lot, things I didn't like. I mostly rue it because it's what introduced Lois Lane's purple eyes, and they've made their way into the comics and drives me nuts who has purple eyes. But but that Superman was not such a goody-goody nice guy, and he got angry, and he actually was a hothead in that show. They didn't characterize him by somebody standing up saying, you are a hothead, but they showed it that he was. But that show had some real good strengths, and that episode was the very finale. That's the only time in the whole show he kisses Lois.
Oh, really? I didn't even notice that.
That's how it ends. And I also like, you know, so Darkseid was created by Jack Kirby as basically Space Hitler. That was basically the idea. This kind of ultimate, Aristotelian ideal of fascism, you know, Platonic ideal of fascism. And the fact that Superman would punch him when Superman was created as a reaction to the rise of Nazism, that's sort of the impetus, to me came full circle. And it makes sense, right? I mean, he is Superman. He constantly holds himself in check. And when he lets loose, you need to be, that's scary. But you know,
Well, I think that's the kind of interesting about the idea that one, Darkseid is considered a new god by Kirby. He was created as one of the new gods, as some of the other characters like Orion, some of those other characters. So the fact that Superman can go toe-to-toe with him, does not that put him in the category of god as well? And also the Kryptonians would have then been a planet of gods on some level. They would have been the potential for that power if they ever left their own planet.
Right. Well, there have been many versions. In the original Superman comics, they were all super on Krypton. They flew around, and that's come and gone over the years. And then we've had so many stories where Kryptonians en masse, you know, whether it's imaginaries or whether it's in canon or whatever, become some sort of super race and populate and take over and whatnot. And it depends on the definition of God. If lifting up a car makes you a deity, then, you know, why not? Then the Hulk is a God, and, you know, the Thing is a God. The interesting thing in the original Kirby work on the new gods is that they just happen to be strong or have superpowers, is that their existence was not purely physical. There's a lot of metaphysical stuff, whether it's the anti-life equation or the source wall. You know, they have all these kind of things that are, he really conveyed this. I mean, it was very messy in terms of narrative. He really could have benefited from an editor to rein him in a little bit. But, you know, his ideas were just an explosion of creativity. And you really got the sense that these guys manifested physically. They were interacting as beings, but there's a whole other level to it going on. Almost like, you know, biblical angels kind of thing, where it's just a manifestation of something. And that's been touched upon here and there over the years. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, Superman is a corporeal being. You know, he's physical. He's not a god. But he can punch Darkseid, which is still very cool.
Well, it kind of brings it back to, when we're talking about God is religion, is your book, and I want to make sure we really hit on it because I think it's fascinating. You wrote a book called Is Superman Circumcised? Which is a phenomenal book, though it does beg the question, how would they actually circumcise them? But I'm sure Kryptonite knife, I suppose. But Connect, anyways,
I will answer all this and more.
But so how did that idea like progress? I know that when you were at New York University, I believe it was, where you started working on your master's thesis. I know the book was part of, or the aspects of the book came out in a thesis that you wrote. How did you then develop it from thesis to book?
Okay. So those are like three different questions in one. So I'm going to try and answer them very quickly so I don't bore anybody listening. So yeah, the germ of the idea started as an NYU thesis. Which wasn't really that much about Superman. It was about the concept of the hero figure and heroism as a concept in the Jewish Western tradition versus the Christian Western tradition, Europe and America particularly. And they sort of followed, you know, and there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of similarity, but also there's quite a few differences. So I sort of follow that, and I start with biblical characters, and then I go through all kinds of European, you know, from Robin Hood through miracle working rabbis through the Golem of Prague through all, you know, King Arthur, all kinds of figures. King Arthur, for example, may very well have been inspired by a Talmud legend about Moses, and it's something people don't know about. And it ends up with American comic books, which I sort of argue are the modern culmination. That won, NYU has an annual thesis competition, it won second place, it got a little bit of press, one thing led to another. 6.5 years later, it's a book, but in a very different topic. And the subtitle of the book tells you what it's about. It's the complete Jewish history of the world's greatest hero. And what I mean by that, it's not a book by a Jew for Jews about Judaism using comics. That's not what it's about. It's about comics from the Jewish perspective, in the same way that if you wrote a history book about jazz, it would have to be from the Black American perspective, because that's where it was born and raised. Right, in New Orleans and the Harlem Renaissance in the early 20th century. So you don't even have to care about that part of history, but that's a perspective it takes, because that's where it was born and kind of raised. So that's one. Regarding the title, is Superman circumcised? It's cheeky. It's supposed to be funny. I'm not trying to exploit anything. I'm not trying to insult anybody. First of all, you'd be amazed by how many people are either offended or think that the book is literally about that. it's a 300 page book with 100 images. What do you think is going on in the book?
How to, apparently. It's how to manual.
Clearly. It's like, no, clearly it's a silly title. What do you think, that To Kill a Mockingbird is about abusing animals? Like, who I don't get the logic behind. So, you know, I qualify, but I get asked this so many times that I've come up with an answer. Are you ready?
Sure.
On planet Krypton, his dad's name was Jor-El. He was born Kal-El. So he was circumcised by Moyel.
Very nice.
My dad joke du jour.
Well, I mean, like I said, part of the book is focusing on how defining Superman as a product of Jewish people and culture. As someone as well, I mean, I'm Jewish, as probably people have known, show club mentioned before. I guess the important question then is, why is it important culturally to the Jewish people to have Superman identify as a Jewish character?
So when I say Superman is Jewish, I don't mean the Superman in the comics, the canonical Superman, whatever version of it you're talking. You know, that guy was raised Christian. First of all, he's an alien. So whether or not he can even be Christian or Jewish, he biologically, he might as well be like an elephant. It doesn't matter. he's not a human, you know, he can be. But he was raised, you know, Methodist or Protestant. That's in canon. They went to church when he was a kid. He's not practicing as an adult, but he's still. So all this is canon. What I mean when I say he's Jewish is that he's a Jewish character. He was created by Jews, but they also, it's not just happenstance. They borrowed all kinds of elements from Jewish culture, which we're going to go into, to create him. A lot of his DNA is Jewish, and he was developed throughout most of his life, about 50 out of those 80 years, in a Jewish context that kept borrowing Jewish elements. So when I say he's Jewish, I mean that. And this is to come at the expense of his, you know, being him being a Christ metaphor. He's also that, and that's great. And, you know, I'm not it's not about ownership. It's not about appropriating or kind of revisionistically. It's about noting a whole thread of contribution. As far as I'm concerned, it's just enriching the backstory. It's not taking away from anything else.
Well, what, now that you say that, what has me thinking is, like, in your book, right, you make a suggestion, and I might be a little wrong how I read it, and which is fine, you're here to correct me, where you suggested a little bit that some of the Jesus imagery, especially in the Snyder version of the movies, was an attempt to placate conservative America to get them to watch the movie. So is that not then an active attempt to Christianize the character culturally for the profit of, for Warner Brother profit?
It was deliberate and conscious. That isn't to say that, you know, I don't have a principled problem with it. The problem I have with it is, and it's the same problem that I have with the social activism of the later seasons of Supergirl, in contrast to the social activism in the first two seasons of Supergirl, which is, as long as it's the background, as long as story first, metaphor second, it's all good. whether I like it or don't like it, agree or don't agree, you know, as long as it's a story first. The show is called Supergirl, not Soapbox Girl, you know. But once the story feels like it's just lip service, like it's just tokenism in service of some sort of soapbox, then you lose me. And I think they did overstep that with Man of Steel. So the Christ metaphors don't come from the comics. They come from the movies. They really start with 78 movie and then Smallville and all that kind of stuff. There's nothing Christological in the comics until the Death and Return in 92, 93. Just nothing. When they made Man of Steel, Warner Brothers actually did intentionally pursue the Christian faith-based demographic. They had websites for that. They invited all kinds of pastors. They prepared sermons and short videos. There's a whole cut trail of the movie emphasizing the Christian aspects. So Warner Brothers were very deliberate and knew exactly what they were doing. And there's like a whole list of sources in the book I put at the back end of exactly what they did and how they did it. But it's not conspiratorial. They're just out to make a money. You know, that's what they're, you know, their business.
So that's what I was wondering. Like, it was part of the book to remind people of Superman's origin of the Jewish from a Jewish writer standpoint, Jewish cultural standpoint, to be like, I know this is what's being done, but remember, guys, this is Siegel and Schuster were Jews from, you know.
Right. If it's reclamation, it's a good question. Maybe a little bit. Not as sort of a mission statement, but maybe on some level, sort of, hey. You know. But the thing about Superman is, you know, Jews may know that superheroes are very Jewish. Comic book fans may know that superheroes have Jewish origins. The average person doesn't know and doesn't care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wrote this book for comic book fans, and I wrote this book for people who maybe want to learn a little bit about Judaism. And I also wrote this book for the general person who just wants to learn about Jewish American pop culture history. That's really sort of the core of it. And, you know, Jews, the comic book medium is a Jewish invention. The superhero genre is a Jewish invention.
Yes.
Superman is a Jewish invention, and it's not just historical context that's happenstance. There are a lot of themes built into that. And again, it doesn't come at the expense of anything else. It's not, you know, but I think it's interesting and it's worth noting. And if you are a true fan, it only enriches your understanding and experience.
Yeah, and I think one thing that's also interesting that you do also reference Superman and the time period and how he's portrayed alongside issues in culture of anti-Semitism that was going on not only during World War II that was bringing up, but also later around the Snyder time when you also started getting an influx as well as anti-Semitism that started occurring in the 2010s a little bit. And once again, is there also a connection there as well?
You know, the book took me, when I started the thesis upon which this book is based, actually, there wasn't that much literature on this. A lot came in the years and years it took me to write this thing. So I sort of was late to the party, but I left home early, you know? So there wasn't much of a reaction to anti-Semitism, except that when I moved to the States in 2004, which is before the current kind of tsunami of mainstream anti-Semitism, I was surprised by just how much there was and how much it was not on the cultural radar, where if it was racism against somebody based on their color, or if it's bigotry based on somebody's other religion or gender or sex or sexual orientation, that was on the radar and people who cared were aware of it. But when it came to Jews, it was just not on the radar. People got away with saying and doing and thinking things that were very clearly bigoted towards Jews in one way or another that just wasn't on the radar. So that's been part of my experience in America as an Israeli Jew. That said, the book wasn't a reaction directly to that, but here's the thing. There are thousands of superheroes, and many of them can leap tall buildings in a single bound. They're faster than a speeding bullet. They're more powerful than a locomotive. What's special about Superman? And the answer is what he stands for. He inspires in a way that no other character does. He stands for hope and self-betterment in a better tomorrow, right? Now it's part of his own. Like no other character. You know, you leave the first Superman movie feeling like you want to be a better person.
Yes.
not many other superhero movies do that for you, right? And I probably, some part of me, the more kitschy, cheesy, schmaltzy part of me, wanted that to be in the book, especially sort of the call to action at the end of saying, hey, you know, it was all fun and games, it's entertainment, but there's something really valuable to learn here. How about we look up in the sky and see ourselves, you know?
I mean, I think Superman's always at his best when he does not follow cynical storylines. Like I said, I think later on they tried to make him more cynical, like the storylines around him, but I think he's always been at his best when he's kept away from it and stayed the big blue Boy Scout. I think that is his character, and I think there's nothing wrong with having him in the modern world with that philosophy. And I think that's also why I think Captain America, the way Marvel did Captain America in the Marvel movies, was very much Superman in some ways. I mean,
it was perfect.
He's a big blue Boy Scout, inherently good, but not stupid. He's a little naive, but he figures it out later on that keep your eyes out a little bit.
That's the thing. My interpretation of Big Blue Boy Scout is that he makes the choice. Listen, any teenager can be Wolverine in personality. I'm OP. I'm constantly cynical. Listen, not believing anything requires just amount of non-thinking as believing everything.
Right? True. Yes.
Listen, Wolverine is cool. He's very cool. But to me, he's just a teenager. Like, the dude is 150 years old. Get enough with the attitude, you know? Superman is more of a grown-up. And that's part of why some people find him to be boring, because he thinks before he takes action. And he thinks of the consequences. And he's not about, you know, strutting and that kind of stuff. He has compassion. He's not armed. He's not angry. He doesn't grit his teeth. He doesn't kill anybody. But I want better heroes. I want people who make, you know. And to me, the Big Blue Boy Scout means that he is he's not cynical. Cynicism is the true kryptonite of Superman, right? But I wouldn't make him naive. I don't think he's naive. Certainly not Captain America, a guy who fought during World War II. You know, I love these people who's, you know, what's the worst thing they've ever seen? A long line of targets. But they think Captain America's naive. Like, what are you talking about? You know? The guy lived through the entire World War. The last thing in the world he's going to be is naive. It's a conscious choice. And I think actually Chris Evans was perfect. And really gets full credit for that. But yes, they need to do that. They need to follow those footsteps. Yeah.
So is Superman the idealistic Big Blue Boy Scout because he truly believes it? Or does he have the luxury, because he's Superman, of being that way?
Ooh, good question. I like idealistic. You know, I say in the book, maybe he loves humanity in a way that only somebody who can't be hurt by it can.
That's interesting. Okay.
Right?
Can you dig into that more?
I mean, you know, it's in some level, it's easier to love something when you're always on the outside and when you're always trying to get on the inside and when you really aren't, you know, he can get hurt emotionally in all kinds of ways, but his lived experience is very different from us, right? He doesn't get the slings and arrows of Hamlet in the same way that we all do, right? He doesn't suffer that kind of existentialism.
Yeah.
And in a way that sort of, it's a privileged perspective, let alone also, listen, not to be unnecessarily kind of social political, but he was also had the fortune of being a handsome white man, which, you know, his experience would have been very different had he been not those things, right? So there's something there too. And there have been issues that touched on that, some tastefully and some less so.
Well, supposedly it wasn't Michael B. Jordan's gonna have a movie where he plays a black Superman, which could be fascinating how they play that angle up. Changes the character.
I don't know if Jordan is, but Ta-Nehisi Coates is writing it.
Yeah.
And listen, it's about how they do it, not what they do. You know, I always look at the Winter Soldier as a good example of a terrible idea that was executed perfect.
Right.
It's a terrible idea. Think about it. But they really got away with it because of the execution. So it's all about, you know, like anything else in life. It's not so much the what as the how.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think with that idea of it, the black idea of the black Superman is to have him be a black Superman, even from Krypton and come down, would have to change him very distinctly as a character.
Sure.
Especially if he grew up in Kansas as a black Superman, that would probably definitely change his how his character develops over time.
Yeah, I would. But but also I hope they don't go too realistic or too preachy with that. I think those two are gonna hurt. Again, I think story comes first. Story, you know, Stan Lee said that any story without message is like a person without a soul. And I think that's true, but it should be a story first, right? The, you know, I don't think I think Superman makes a choice. I think every day he makes a choice whether to live up to a higher ideal that he himself stand, you know, and that's something we should all do. We all have a choice every minute, every action, every, you know, do we do better? Do we troll this person on social media or do we behave politely? Do we show kindness to the old lady driving in front of us or do we honk the horn? It's like little things that add up. And he just makes these choices in a much more dramatic, colorful, hyperbolic fashion. It's not very subtle, but it's the same stuff.
Well, interesting that you mentioned the idea of choices. You mentioned in your book, and there's a large part of the book, and we'll go into maybe some more detail on it later, how the story of Superman is both inspired by Moses and potentially inspired by Jesus as well, the story of Jesus.
As well as Samson and the Golem of Prague, and
Right, well, I'm going to focus on Moses and Jesus for a little bit. But you have those two characters that on some level, while they're making a choice, the choice is also partly being forced upon them because of who they become. Jesus is the Son of God in the mythology. Thus, he has to do these things. So that's what he's here to do. Moses, once he's, you know, spoken to by God, kind of is in a position where he kind of has to do these things. So that's what he's supposed to do. Superman is, when he put on this plan, he goes to the Fortress of Solitude, talks to his father. The father's like, this is your goal. This is what you're kind of why, in the movie especially, this is why you're here. How much is the choice directly his and how much is the pressure of supposed to being this guy?
Right. Yet another good question. So without opening the barrel of, you know, worms of the, without going into the issue of Judeo-Christian determinism versus free will and theodicy and ontology, wonderful things, not for
right.
The, you know, in the movie, they can be a great people, Kal-El. They wish to be. They only like to, they like to show the way. For this reason, above all, the capacity for good. I've sent them you, my only son. For two things. First of all, it reads very Jesus-y, and people have taken it as very Jesus-y. But here's the interesting thing: it is almost verbatim the burning bush speech from Exodus. Instead of you know, my son, I am your father. It's I am the God of your father. Instead of, you know, they can be a great people. They are my people. They're meant for greatness. It's just like, it's almost exactly the same, which I thought was fascinating and not something I ever connected until I researched the book. Also thematically, think about it in the movie, right? Cause these elements have been folded into the comics, but they start from the movie, this particular kind of idea. He turns 18, grabs the green crystal, goes on a walkabout across the North Pole, makes the Fortress of Solitude, sees this bright apparition of his father. He tells him where he's really from, sends him back into the world. That's the burning bush. The whole thing is the scene of the burning bush. Moses, 18, desert of Midian, burning bush. Here's who you are. Here's what you're. It just, nobody ever connected those dots before. And I absolutely do not think this is all coincidental or just me reading too much into it. It's there, you know, and which I try to be responsible about in the book. But in the comics, Superman was not saved by a celestial father to save us from ourselves. That's a movie thing, and that does not appear in the comics until much, much later. He was a refugee sent by a desperate father who had no other way to save him. He was the Kinder transport, the kids sent out of Nazi-occupied Europe last minute. You know, he was he's a refugee, and that's what he is. And he got saved by chance, not by destiny, even though they're all kind of stories of, you know, what this is really what happened, that kind of stuff. But it was really by chance. And here's the thing. What saved Superman is the kindness of simple Americans. Because when he landed here, he was a vulnerable baby, even if he was super, right? But he was still a baby. But they had to take him in and shelter him and raise him and feed him and teach him. But they instilled in him American values. And the superpowers of his ethnic heritage combined with the American values are what creates Superman. And how great of a promise that is in a nation of immigrants at such a time in history when it was created. It's such a powerful reminder that being all American is being an immigrant.
You know, I think a great example of what you mentioned on the flip side, as you said, you saw all of them. So, and you read all, you know, the Flashpoint series and the animated movie where Superman doesn't land in Kansas. He lands, I guess it's probably in the city, Metropolis, wherever. And the government has a hold of him, and he's pretty much a destroyed individual. So yes, I mean, it is that is a great evidence of the difference between What happens if the Kents were to find him, or what happens if Uncle Sam found him first? And I think the cartoon, the animated movie, only hit on it briefly, but it's a fascinating concept.
There is a bunch of, we call them what ifs today, but back then, Julia Schwartz would call them imaginary stories. In Superman, where, you know, what if, and he gets raised by different people, Lex Luthor and all these kind of things. There's one story where his twin brother from Krypton lands somewhere else and gets raised by Quarks to be a super criminal. So there's all these kind of stories. So one of the most popular ones, of course, is Red Sun. Mark Millar's story. And I'm pretty much convinced that idea from that came from him reading the Mario Puzo first draft of the Superman movie script. So one of the things I did, because I guess I had too much time, was read all the different drafts of the Superman movie script. It's a big script. And just trace down the differences and whom contributed what, you know. And in the original Puzo script, he describes the rocket ship approaching Earth right above the Soviet Union to make the audience feel like, oh no, is he going to land in the Soviet Union? What would happen then? And then you see the rocket kind of veer around the Earth's curvature and land in Kansas. But it's supposed to implant in your head as the audience the, oh wow, imagine that. And that doesn't quite make it in any clear way to the final movie. You see him go over the Earth. You can't see what's down there. I'm pretty sure Mark Millar at some point read that, and that's where he got the idea. But you'd have to ask him next time he's on your show.
If you know him, you're welcome to send him an invite.
No, I didn't have the pleasure, but I'll shoot him a line. There have been plenty of stories. And there's Grant Morrison wrote the... what was the one? The one where the multiversity one, where he's raised by Hitler and he's the Übermensch, right?
Well, I mean, I think talking about ideas and inspiration, because you talk a lot about Siegel and Schuster, and one thing you kind of bring up is how much is the connection between Superman and Moses, or Superman and the Torah, intentional, and how much was either subconsciously done because they just knew the story so well that it kind of leaked in, and how much was it because some stories and some tropes are so good that they just repeat themselves over and over again. So in your expert opinion, is it more of a trope that just everyone knows works and got repeated? Was it subconscious, or were they sitting going, this is our character, you know, and we are going to direct them to the story that we know of Moses the best, and this is what we're going to make with them?
I think a mix of all three. Sort of these Venn diagrams, you know, I try to be very responsible in the book, saying this is what we know factually because they said so. This is what's sort of self-evident, you know, the origin story of the baby and the thing being the same as Moses, right? This is what's likely. This is what's possible. This is just pure conjecture, and this is just playful. I try to be very responsible and sort of divide those things as I go along, particularly because people have overstated points before me, and I wanted to distinguish myself from that, from arguments that, you know, you're only hurting yourself if you're... if you're kind of overextending your argument. So in 1979, when the Superman movie came out, Jerry Siegel wrote a memoir, a very detailed memoir about all the influences and the whole process of how he came up with the idea of Superman in his early years. It's like a historical treasure trove. And it got immediately lost, never got published. And it was only written about, it was found in 2011. And the only person to ever write about that before me was Larry Tye in the book Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Favorite Hero. And I got my hands on it, scanned the whole thing. I have a copy, very happy. And in it, he says, listen, I was absolutely inspired by Samson. And they homage Samson on the cover of Superman 4, deliberate and intentional. And they refer to Superman as a modern Samson, or possessing the strength of a dozen Samsons that are throughout the Golden Age. And he also was conscious to, in borrowing from the Golem of Prague, the indestructible, indefatigable champion of the oppressed. The Golem of Prague also was used one-to-one as the origin of Bizarro in 1958. It's the exact same story. And particularly the 1920 movie kind of take on it. And more than that, in the memoir, as well as in other interviews, Siegel and Schuster said, listen, the main impetus, the main thing that spurred us to come up with the idea of this guy was the rise of Nazis in Europe and anti-Semitism in America. That was really what he was created to do, to punch Nazis. And with all due respect to Captain America, he beat Captain America to it.
So one question, I mean, once again, you're talking about a memoir that's written in 1979. The character was created in 1938.
Debuted in 1938.
Debuted. So, yeah. Okay. So give a year or so of the development for it to get there.
Six.
So I guess one question would be, did it take 40 something years for that to come out? Because there would have been a concern if he had earlier on said he's based on Jewish ideas when they were trying to get the character to be recognized by wider audiences.
It's a good question. And I also try to answer that in the book. I actually trace, amongst other things, all the references to the Jewish origins of superheroes in general, Superman in particular, and where's the first one, how did it evolve, the first, you know, I try to kind of trace the line of that. So creating a character that was Jewish or even Jewish metaphorically would have been a non-starter back then. Anti-Semitism was intense. They have Pew surveys by which about 60% of the American public was anti-Semitic. And these were lenient surveys to begin with.
Nice.
It's in the book. That's what the end notes are for. So yeah, yeah. Things were, they're not good enough now, but they're certainly worse then. And I think it's a combination of things. I think there's enough critical mass of serious attention to comics that enough people started noticing enough things. I think the mythology has evolved enough, just like biological evolution, where you start saying, hey, I see the trait in this animal, let's look at the traits in that kind of ancestor. I think that's part of it. And I think part of it is also this kind of post 9/11 engagement with religiosity and its place in culture. I think that's also a big part of it. And aside from that, it's anybody's guess. But it's there. That's the thing. It's there. You know, once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, but third time, fourth time, fifth time, right. There's a pattern.
Well, I think right now in the world of comic books, for anyone who's has steeped into comic book culture right now, know that for the last maybe 5 or 6, 7 years, there's been two major debate, and it kind of separated two different groups between, are politics belong comic books, do politics not belong comic books? Now, it sounds like Superman seems to be the best argument that politics have been intertwined with comic books since the very start. Once again, a guy was punching landlords, slumlords, whatever, at the beginning. It seems to be permanently intertwined. Would you agree that politics and comic books have been intertwined basically since inception?
Yes. Superman was a political propaganda figure. He supported British rearmament, which was unpopular. He supported intervention, which was unpopular. He supported immigration reform, which was unpopular. He supported the New Deal, which was, you know, quasi depending who. He was always a political figure and always a propaganda figure, and all superheroes were. And they paid the price for it. They got death threats. They got all kinds of things, and which is its own fascinating little side of the story. To say that, first of all, everything is political. Let's the broader sense of political, anything is a political act, anything and everything. There's a difference, though, between being political and having a point and then smacking you on the head with it, or being preachy or being heavy-handed. And that's the point I was making earlier, that as long as story comes first, that's all good. You know, and it doesn't matter if it's arguing something I agree more or I agree with less with. If it's tasteful, I'm on board. When you shove it down my throat, just wrapped in some nice package of you know, the pretense of a story, that's when I have an issue. Even if I agree with your point wholeheartedly, it still bothers me, because I'm paying $4 for, you know, a comic book called Superman, not a comic book called, you know, whatever, you know, Hardcore Republican or Bleeding Heart Liberal. That's, if I want to spend money on that, I'd buy something called that. You know what I mean? having said that, I will add one more thing, and that is, I don't know if the comics have become more political or just the audience. I think pop culture has become politicized to a great fault, and we just see everything through that prism. And not everything is that prism.
Right. No, I agree with you completely on that. I just think it's an interesting argument when people say politics don't belong comic books. Like, comic books have been political forever. And as you said, everything is political, including not action. To take no stance is actually political just as much as being taking a liberal or conservative stance.
You wake up in the morning, you're a citizen of this country. In theory, you have choices to not be a citizen of this country.
Right.
And to be a citizen of a different country. Or to not wake up in the morning where you are. Everything is in some level of political action. What you make from that is, you know, that's kind of philosophical, but yeah, of course they're going to be political. What entertainment is not political exactly? Trick is, it needs to be tasteful. That's the only thing.
You know, I think one another great thing that you discuss in your book is Superman's impact on future Jewish pieces of literature, such as Maus and Will Eisner's A Contract with God. And would you, is it fair to argue or suggest that those books wouldn't exist if Superman wasn't, or things of these didn't steep the world in saying, you know, Jews are part of comic books and this is something that's more, became more acceptable?
I subscribe to the argument that if not for Superman and not for superheroes, and superheroes get their super from Superman, he's the first, you know, there would be no comic books as we know them. Comic books started as reprints of comic strips. All people thought about were political cartoons and little funnies. That's why they're called comic books, right? Sunday funnies and the strips. The idea of them standing on their own, the idea of people spending money just for them, the idea of being genres like action or detective, that all comes, you know, it predates Superman. He shows up in 38. The first comic is New Fun Comics 1, as we recognize the first comic in 35. Well, funnies on parade, but it doesn't matter. The point is, depends on format and how you look at it. The point is 34, 35. The point is that if not for Superman, this would most likely have been a fly-by-night, ephemeral, short-lived industry. And it would not, definitely not would have been it is today. whether or not there would have been room in the evolutionary tree of the medium to accommodate big monographs like A Contract with God or Maus, I don't know. You know, things mature anyway, but probably not. There definitely wouldn't be a market for it. You know, when Maus came out, who was selling this thing? You know, there wouldn't be a direct market. There wouldn't be comic book sections in stores. They didn't know what to do with Maus. Is it fiction or is it not fiction? It's a biography or not a biography, but it's mice. What do you consider? It was like a big thing when, yeah. So, yes, I think that ultimately we owe Superman. It starts with him. He created and exhausted the whole thing.
Well, I think an interesting question about Superman as well, I think people might have is, as you said, Superman is responsible for the industry. Superman, because he was, you know, the first, he helped create it. Do you think Superman, part of Superman's popularity is that he is on some level the template, the first. Do you think he would have reached that level of popularity if he came out later, if Batman was the first and then Captain America and then, or do you think part of his appeal is that he is, you know, he is the first, the template. And that's, like I said, in the world of DC Comics and everything else, he's always portrayed as the you know, he is the you know, the exemplar, the very first, and that's part of his thing as well.
Right. It's hard to answer simply because Batman and Captain America could not have come out before him because the idea didn't exist.
True.
Despite what Bob Kane wrote in his biography, Batman and Me, when he shows those doodles he made as a teenager that now we all know is like a blatant lie, like a bold-faced, shameless lie. It's a grown man doing doodles and pretending he was 13 when he did it. But Superman was the first idea. There was no, you know, the guy was so innovative that between 1934, when Siegel and Shuster finished the familiar version for the first time, and 1938, for 4 years, they pitched him to every single newspaper syndicate in the United States, and every single one rejected him. Too gimmicky, too stupid, infantile. My favorite King Feature Syndicate, which was one of the two big ones, said, the idea is too fantastic. Kids would never relate. You can't invent this stuff.
Right.
And, you know, there was unprecedented. Nobody would have thought of Captain America or Batman before Superman. That's a theoretical construct that I'm not sure how to kind of unfold. Superman is the first, and he created the whole genre. You know, he seemed like such an insane idea at the time. People didn't know what to do with him. But that's part of the charm, right?
Yeah, one thing also you mentioned as well when you talk about Maus and Will Eisner is that during that same period of time, there was a decline in Jewish representation in the writing of comic books at that point. You mentioned, I'm trying to remember the exact phrase, you said, the same section does suggest that this even through the representation of Jewish talent in comics was waning. Do you think that was just significant, or do you think that's just the pendulum moving
pendulum,
in one direction?
Just pendulum.
Other?
I think part of it is just that, you know, Jews created comics because they couldn't get a job. First of all, it was the Depression. And second, they were Jews. You know, Jews need not apply to any respectable job back then. And they created whole cloth, you know. Jews created comics out of whole cloth because they couldn't get a job doing anything else. If you're a writer, a magazine wouldn't take you. If you were an artist, you couldn't do set design, or an ad agency wouldn't take you. If you're an entrepreneur, you know, no bank would lend you money, et cetera, et cetera. They created comics out of nothing because they had to get, you know. Once comics became a bit more serious, then these guys are not poor immigrants anymore. It's not the Depression. It's not the war. Anti-Semitism is not that rife. They move on. They become doctors and architects and bankers and lawyers and, you know, dentists and serious authors and whatever. The other thing is, while Jews were still heavily represented in comics, the industry grew enough to include other voices. So they just by proportion became fewer. But I think that strengthened the industry. I want it to be everybody's industry. I don't want to keep it some clannish club.
I agree with you 100% on that. I think another part that you mentioned, we kind of hit on a little bit, is that you also mentioned how Superman acted as a counter to the trend of darker heroes from the 80s. Mm-hmm. Do you think, once again, is there a place for a darker version of Superman, or are you missing the point once you do it?
Depends how dark you go.
Okay.
You know, I don't think it needs to be squeaky clean. I don't think you're compromising the character by making him get angry or by making, but how far can you stretch him before he's not Superman anymore? In that sense, I give credit to Batman as the most protean of all superheroes. He really works in the widest range of variety of versions, you know. It can be anything from super camp all the way to flat out R-rated horror and still work. Superman has a much narrower range before you stop, you know, he stops being Superman. So it depends how dark. And the thing is this, if you remember the CW had that crisis crossover.
Yeah.
And Ben Roth has a good line where paraphrasing, I don't remember, it was like the light that shines through the darkness that reminds us. And it's true, that's what Superman is. He can be in a dark place. He cannot be dark. Those are two different things. That's not what he's about. Which is why when I see these stories about, you know, the Joker killed Lois and then Superman goes crazy and takes over the, and by the way, I love Tom Taylor. I love Injustice, but I don't buy it. I don't buy that one thing, no matter how horrible, would send Superman into a tailspin. Since when is he weaker than the rest of us?
Well, how about the Man of Steel when he snaps General Zod's neck? Is that Superman or not Superman? Because the argument, obviously, is he had no choice. He doesn't kill civilians. But the argument of comic books is there's always another choice.
Right.
Is that not Superman then?
My grandma, who was the wisest person in the world, used to say, that may explain it, but it doesn't excuse it. So the idea that Superman had no choice, like, don't put him in that position to begin with. What do you mean? But if in reality, okay, so if in reality he got syphilis, I don't need to see this. It's not part of the story. You know what I mean? Like, he should not be in a position where he has no other choice, and that's the choice he makes. Don't put him in that. Do that with Batman. Do that with whatever. Do that with the Punisher. Go nuts, you know. But don't. So I understood it. I just didn't buy it. Aside from little things like, wait, Zod can't just like move his eyes to the side. The whole head needs to move. Like little things that. But or Superman can't just like step in front of it and absorb it. Whatever. But what really bothered me is the final battle in Metropolis. And some people say it's nitpicking, and it's not. The final battle in Metropolis is 40 minutes of screen time. He doesn't spend 2 seconds showing the slightest bit of concern for collateral damage. The idea that he was trying to finish the fight as quickly as possible is entirely conjectural in what people read into. There's nothing in the movie to imply this. In the Christopher Reeve Superman 2, there's that scene where he goes, the people, you're hurting the people. And then he flies away to draw them away. That's 2 seconds. The people are hurting. Like, there's 40 minutes of carnage. Where is his concern? Show me, like, an expression, something.
You know, I had thought about that scene many times. And I thought to myself, all you need, if you wanted the fight in Metropolis, you need the destruction because it's good TV. I mean, good viewing. All you need is, for a moment, is Superman trying to fly away, trying to get him to go with him, and then Zod not following and still destroying things. Okay, now he can't leave. But at least you need that moment of him trying to leave.
Right, right. or a building collapses and he tries desperately to save the people, but he can't because there's only so much he can do and he's upset. And then he's sort of determined to take Zod out quickly. Good acting can convey all that without any dialogue right. in a few seconds, you know? And I think Henry Cavill would have been able to pull it off. I think he's capable enough to do that.
He showed promise in some parts of Justice League, some parts.
Yeah, I don't think he's a bad actor. I mean, I don't think he's Christopher Reeve, but I don't think he's a bad actor. I just don't think he was ever given any instructions, but, you know, furl your brow and stare.
Well, I did. The part that always bothered me the most in the Snyderverse movies, and for fans of, if you're a fan of the movie, I will shit on it. I don't care. You can argue all, you can tell me all you want. That he inspired, that he represents hope, but unless he actually is doing anything to inspire hope, it sounds like bullshit. It's like if it reminds me, like as a teacher, I teach writing, the show not tell. You can tell me all you want that he inspires hope, but if you're not showing it, it's not, there's no value to it. And he spent all your time saying, in the first two movies, Man of Steel and Batman vs Superman, he is hope. He gives everyone something to aspire to. He's like, no, he's not on film, apparently. Something off film, but not on
By
film.
By the way, just a little pet peeve that I have to share. What's with the V instead of VS? Is it a lawsuit? Is Batman suing Superman? But anyway, just a pet peeve. My day job is at a law firm. V is only for lawsuits. There's no, you don't use it for anything
else. Well, maybe he sued Batman in a separate part of the movie.
Yeah, exactly right. The you know, not just fans, but the writers of these movies said, no, but he has to grow to become Superman. He has to learn how to become Superman. And I think, no. First of all, you want to do that? Why do you want, you know, $45 of my money and 6 or 8 hours of my time before I'm ready to see Superman? You're done. Call me when you're ready. Then I'll show up. Like, what is this? He needs to learn how to be Superman. I'm paying money to see Superman. What are you talking about?
Right.
I find that completely unacceptable as an explanation. And second, the idea that he would have to kill somebody in order to learn to appreciate life, and that he would have to be this mopey emo guy in order to learn to lighten up a bit, completely misses the whole purpose of his childhood upbringing.
Right.
You know, completely. Wait, I would never take a life unless in certain circumstances, self-defense or protecting another. I wouldn't go just go around saying, I don't like this, but I'm going to kill them. Do I need to kill somebody to learn that lesson?
Hopefully not.
Is that how that works? I just found this logic completely unacceptable.
I thought the movie was, I mean, there's certain aspects of the movie that was fascinating, and I kind of was interested, but... Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Certain aspects of Man of Steel that I thought was kind of fascinating, you know, and some of the stuff that they did, but I did feel it failed in conception. It conceptually failed the very idea of Superman. And I find it surprising how strong the following is for those movies, because I feel like if your following is that strong, then you never understood it.
I don't know if the following is strong as much as the following is loud.
True.
The example I like to give is the number of people that signed the petition to complete the Snyder Cut is about the same or slightly less than the number of people who actually watched the whole thing on HBO Max. So, you know, that says a lot.
Right.
You know, it's like voting. It's very easy to click a like on Facebook, but do you actually show up and vote? I mean, do you actually
right.
You know, you know, it's loud, but I don't know if it's, you know, does anybody really take seriously the Oscar moment given to Snyder for either one of those movies that won? Like, really? So, I mean, it's just loud. And, you know, people who have time and energy to tweet a lot. And listen, I'm not pooping on them. You like that, all the power to you. Your version is no less or any or no more true than my version. That's all good. But in my view, Man of Steel is actually a really good movie. It's just not a very good Superman movie. That's sort of my take on it. Batman v Superman, I can't give that credit to. I just it's unwatchable and somehow manages to also be boring.
Well, you know, you actually a question popped in my head that you're talking about Superman having to learn to be Superman. Okay, and I once again, since you're the expert, I want your opinion. Superman's origin has come out in two different ways. Version one, he is Clark Kent in Kansas. He becomes Superman, flies to Metropolis. Version two, he's Superboy in Kansas. Does him being Superboy in one version of the story change who he is or how he is what he is, in your opinion?
Yes. And there are other versions, by the way. In the original Golden Age, there was no Smallville. Smallville started with the radio show. Then in the original Golden Age, when they show, like in Superman number one, July 1939, he actually grew up in Metropolis. He went to Metropolis High School. He, as a kid, jumps over the Metropolis skyline. He's a city boy. So that came later, and that changes things. And exactly what Superboy means, you know, we say Superboy, we think of the classic full costume, public persona, right. But that's changed right now in vague continuity. There is a Superboy, but it was only like an urban legend. But then he went to the future of the Legion of Superheroes, where he was super. It's unclear exactly where things stand, but it's something like that. Plausible deniability continuity. I like continuity. I like the consistency of the fantasy. Mm. But if you're starting to kind of hobble your own stories for it, it sort of misses the point, I think. But by the way, as Superboy, he didn't wear glasses as Clark Kent for like a year. So there's, and they didn't change his hair. So there's like a whole year of stories where the only difference was the tights. just noting it, you know.
Before cell phones, though, so no one had a picture.
Yeah, also, nobody had a cell phone, so nobody was with their face in the cell phone all the time. So we actually paid attention to what was going on.
That's true too.
You know, I live in New York, which is one of the cities with the most amazing architectures in the world, and I feel like it's just all for me because everybody's walking in the street with their phone and like banging into each other and then moving sideways like some Frogger. And I'm just like looking at all these neoclassical and gothic and modernist. It's so weird, but. Yes, because if he only grew up on the farm as Clark and there was no Superboy, he never had to become this kind of living billboard. He never had to adopt a true secret identity until he was an adult and much more formed. Mm. And as I said, you know, the bumbling Clark, whether it's more bumbling or less bumbling, is fake, but Superman is Clark from the farm. Meaning Clark on the farm, that's the true Superman. So it's sort of, it's like a Y shape. It's not exactly a binary kind of thing. But once he's Superboy as a kid, it's already early on. And he really spends most of his life, the formative years of his life, as Super. And makes Clark actually much more of a fake.
Hmm.
In that sense.
That's very cool. So, Mr. Rose, for our audience, where can they find Is Superman Circumcised?
Is a Superman Circumcised, the complete Jewish history of the world's greatest hero, is sold on Amazon and everywhere else books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Target, even on the Walmart website. You can find it anywhere books are sold. I also invite you to follow me at royschwartz.com and on Instagram, Facebook, and what's the other one? Twitter, that's the one.
Twitter.
Is at Real Roy Schwartz.
That's so what's next from you? Where do you go from here?
So I write about pop culture from the Jewish perspective for The Forward. That's the largest Jewish newspaper in the States. If you like that kind of stuff, you're welcome to check it out. And I write about pop culture history for CNN. For example, on the 27, but not from the Jewish perspective. The last thing I did was about the history of vampire lore. Next thing comes out on the 22nd of May will be whether or not Sherlock Holmes really predicted forensic science techniques. Just like general pop culture.
That sounds history. Awesome.
Yeah, it's fun stuff. And the one more thing I can't go too deep into is that I'm under contract for my next book, which is a graphic novel.
Oh, fiction. You're doing a fiction
no,
story?
No, nonfiction graphic novel.
Really?
Yeah. But that's
Are you able to say the topic?
I cannot at this point yet. It is a collaborative effort, and I'm actually the second banana on it. So it's not my place to be the one to break the news, but stay tuned.
Well, let me put you in the hot spot for one more second.
Sure.
The nonfiction graphic novel, is this a nonfiction? Huh?
Historical graphic novel.
Historical graphic novel. So this is based on a true story that has occurred,
right?
And you're being told in graphic novel form.
Well, keep in mind, graphic novel is a misnomer because novel means fiction. But yes, this is actually less of a one story and more of a review of a history of a concept. Just told in graphic novel form because it lends itself to visual representation well. And it's under contract with a Wave Blue World, which is
I know them.
Okay, yeah. It already could have come out if I didn't have two jobs and two children. So,
So I'm going to hit you for one more question then on this.
Sure, sure.
The historical graphic novel,
mm-hmm.
That's based on true events, is the story, is it a story being told in a graphic novel, or is it something being explained or taught, sort of almost like a history given in graphic novel?
More the latter, although I try to dramatize certain points. So imagine it like a documentary where here and there it kind of zooms in to give you a reenactment.
Very, it sounds awesome. You got to come back on when it's ready to be published.
Hopefully by next summer, not this summer, but next summer. But you know, it depends on the editorial process. It depends on all kinds of things. So hopefully.
Well, Mr. Schwartz, it was a total pleasure talking with you. I learned a lot about Superman, and I feel like I could talk to you for another few hours, but I don't want to do that.